You're listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton.
The FBI just can't help themselves when it comes to going after the political opposition of the deep state. And in January 6th, it was reported that Bank of America, in the least, had turned over banking records to the FBI of anyone in the D.C. area. So I'm in the D.C. area. So if I had, the way I read the reports, that if I had used my debit card, it could have been turned over to the FBI, even though I wasn't anywhere near the rally or anything else that happened. So all sorts of Americans were caught up in this dragnet, which is illegal. It's illegal under the law. The FBI can't just go around collecting records because they feel like it. So we're trying to figure out what went on. We asked the FBI for the records. You know what they told us? We can't confirm or deny the records exist, which is bunk. That type of response is used to protect, you know, top secret operations and war plans, national security related data. Not like a typical law enforcement technique. Did you do a subpoena or not? I mean, how's that a state secret? It's obviously a lie. And we filed a response to the FBI in the federal court case we brought to get these records. We want to know about this surveillance of American citizens' financial transactions. You know, I think it's interesting. There's all this, I don't know where it stands now in terms of the effort by the left to increase the IRS's power to observe your banking transactions or your banking activity generally. But I think back to, well, the FBI just, you know, it looks like they didn't need a subpoena and they just got the records. I don't know what went on. I mean, what already happened is bad enough. My point is, this is what we sued for. All records of communications between the FBI and any financial institution, including but not limited to Bank of America, Citibank, Chase Manhattan, Bank Discover, and or American Express, in which the FBI sought transaction data for those financial institutions' debit and credit card account holders who made purchases in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and or Virginia on January 5th and 6th, 2021. And so what Judicial Watch says is they can't hide behind this "I can't confirm or deny" excuse. And we first of all, that excuse is almost always blown out of the water if they've confirmed or denied it elsewhere. And there was at least one other FOIA request where they confirmed that they might have records, but they wouldn't turn them over because of law enforcement related exemptions, which is a more straightforward Freedom of Information Act dispute. So A, that's the big deal. B, the second big deal is, if you're engaged in misconduct, you can't say "I can't confirm or deny" to hide the misconduct from the American people. And that's what I want to focus on in our brief. This is what exactly they said, by the way, to the FBI. "Please be advised that it is the FBI's policy to neither confirm nor deny the existence of any records which would disclose the existence or non-existence of non-public law enforcement techniques, procedures, and or guidelines. The acknowledgement that any such records exist or do not exist could reasonably be expected to risk circumvention of law." So the idea that the FBI can monitor your banking transactions is a secret law enforcement technique? Who are they kidding? Talk about corruption. It's what we deal with all the time at Judicial Watch. I'm surprised I'm able to, you know, not just completely have my head explode sometimes dealing with this government lawlessness. And this was what we say. I'm going to read a bit from the brief because there was a former senior FBI official who's done this work before. He knows what the rules are in terms of gathering this type of information. And he gave us a declaration that we could give to the court to explain what was going on here with the FBI's gamesmanship. This is what we wrote. I'm going to read you a few paragraphs. "In this case, the FBI appears to have conducted an improper broad sweep of financial records, not just of those persons it had reason to believe were involved in the events of January 6th, but many more Americans. Detailed media reports not only indicate the FBI, sought financial records, but also set forth in detail the specific criteria and scope of the records obtained. And as described in the declaration of our former FBI friend, such a broad sweep of financial records would be improper. Now, according to the FBI official's declaration, the former FBI official's declaration, the FBI has several legal avenues available to pursue private individuals' financial records. They include obtaining a federal grand jury subpoena, a search warrant, or a national security letter. And of course, at all times, they're supposed to follow the laws, and there are specific rules and regulations that implement those laws in the Justice Department called the Attorney General Guidelines or the Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide. All that was thrown out the window, it looks like. As we explained, or as our FBI official explained, a request by the FBI certain banks to voluntarily turn over to the FBI the private financial transaction data of any bank customer who happened to be in a certain broad geographical area on a certain date could be interpreted as an effort to circumvent protections under the law. That's being nice, isn't it? This is because, as set forth, I said, by those Attorney General guidelines, the FBI may not collect and store intelligence information on an individual, especially when that individual is a U.S. citizen, without articulating reasonable suspicion that the individual was or is or about to be engaged in violation of federal law. So they can't go and look at the phone book of Washington, D.C. I guess I'm showing my age. There are no such things as no more hot phone books anymore, right? And just compile a file on everyone in the phone book. Well, that's what they did, it looks like, potentially, in gathering all this financial data of anyone who actually engaged in financial transactions around January 6th. They just can't keep a file on you without having some fair understanding that you may have committed a crime or could be a suspect or someone important to an investigation. A blanket sweep of all bank customer transactions in a certain area at a certain time does not meet the bare minimum reasonable suspicion threshold, since a significant amount of data would logically include innocent and lawful transactions the FBI does not have a right to collect. As a result, the request by the FBI for voluntary cooperation by the banks would net information the FBI would not otherwise be able to legally obtain. If confirmed, the FBI's efforts would constitute an extra constitutional workaround that potentially enabled inappropriate government surveillance of lawful activities. There you have it. That's the 1/6 investigation that needs to be done, and Judicial Watch is doing it. So as Pelosi continues to use 1/6 as a pretext to harass Trump supporters and try to criminalize objections to the way the elections were conducted in 2020, Judicial Watch steps into the gap to find out what the FBI was doing to spy on American citizens whose only crime was being a resident of the District of Columbia or Maryland and Virginia and engaging in a financial transaction. I mean, so to hear these leftists moan about January 6th while harassing and violating the core fundamental constitutional liberties and rights of citizens just gets my goat. This is why I love Judicial Watch, because we're in court fighting for this. The media ain't doing it. I don't know where the Republicans are. They don't even talk about it. A few do. They're the exceptions that prove the rule in terms of the leadership of Congress, both Republican and Democrat. I don't know what's worse, one party that targets the opposition or the other party that lets it happen without much objection. But This is why Judicial Watch is so important, because we step in irrespective of party. So I don't know how the court's going to rule here. Let me see what this filing is called. Plaintiff's memorandum points in opposition to motion for summary judgment. So I guess the government will reply to this, I think, and then the court will rule. I don't know how long the court's going to take the rule. It's before Judge Lamberth, so we'll see what happens. So if anything happens, I'll let you know. But in the meantime, you can read this material, and I encourage you to do it and to share it and educate yourself and your fellow Americans about what we're doing here. Because what went on and is going on related to January 6th makes what went on in January 6th really seem inconsequential, because it's the governmental abuse using January 6th as a pretext that's the big issue now. Next up are some incredible documents that we got, and what's really incredible is we didn't even have to sue for them. It took them forever to give us the documents, but you know, sometimes we wait a few months and we get some documents. In this case, we filed a FOIA request in February of 2022 to the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which is a Pentagon agency, for documents involving work with a government contractor called Black and Veatch. I think that's how it's pronounced, V-E-A-T-C-H, involving work of any manner with biosafety laboratories in the country of Ukraine. Now, why are we interested in that? You know why we're interested in that, because it was a major controversy. The controversy is, what was the United States doing in Ukraine with these biolabs? Now, we were supporting dangerous biolab, biological investigations in China. And it looks like we've been supporting, under the guise of managing them, dangerous work in Ukraine. And it's come to a head because of the Russia invasion of Ukraine. You know, the Russians were using the biolabs as a pretext to justify their aggression. So the immediate response by the media was, oh, we're not allowed to kind of admit that the U.S. is involved in some really risky, potentially, biolab activity in Ukraine, as opposed to just saying, yeah, well, that's what we're doing, and we were just doing it because we're trying to supposedly reduce the threat. Yeah, so I don't know about you, but I'd like to know why the heck we've been maintaining biolabs in Ukraine, engaged in Lord knows what, for 20 years. I understand after the fall of the Soviet Union, we would have an interest in making sure that such weapons laboratories or biolabs were maintained properly and, frankly, shut down properly. Instead, we've been running them more or less for 20 years in partnership with Ukrainians. Why? That's one of the reasons we do the FOIAs. And of course, you know, in March of 2022, Victoria Nuland, the corrupt Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, why do I say she's corrupt? Because she was part of this anti-Trump Russia smear operation, which saw the abuse and misuse of State Department resources to smear Trump and undermine the peaceful transfer of power in a seditious way. So we're relying on this corrupt official to protect our interest in Ukraine and Russia. But that's an aside. She said Ukraine has biological research facilities, which in fact we are now quite concerned that Russia forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of these research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces should they approach. Well, what are the research materials? So the documents we were able to uncover show that in 2019, I believe, we spent $11 million on programs related to these Ukraine labs. The documents show, let me get the specific, included in the records is an order for supplies or services dated August 1st, 2019, issued by the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. The total amount of the contract award is $11.2 million. It includes approximately 35 contract line items set forth in a statement of work, and it's titled Electronic Integrated Disease Surveillance and Pathogen Asset Control Implementation. The statement of work was not provided, nor was there any explanation for the withholding. So we did get these records voluntarily, but they withheld a lot of information from us that we may ultimately have to sue to obtain. And the other information shows that they were working on seemingly pretty dangerous materials. As I say, there's a lot of language or documents talking about pathogen asset control systems. You don't want to have a pathogen around you generally. You know, it's just the nature of the beast. But that's what this was all about. And let me give you some of the information or some of the material and some of the trainings that they were engaged in, or the United States was engaged in, with our Ukrainian partners, quote, on-the-job training. So one of the pathogens is anthrax. The documents refer to a Ukrainian biolab, their PAC, pathogen asset control system, on-the-job training that was conducted for anthrax laboratory activities in December of 2018. Okay, I want you to hear that again. We were working on anthrax laboratory activities, pathogen asset control systems related to anthrax laboratory activities in December of 2018. Why on earth are we maintaining anthrax labs in Ukraine? Why? Why aren't we shutting them down? And the other documents show we're training virtually their entire top staff in these labs. The head of the anthrax laboratory, the senior researcher laboratory of bacterial animal diseases, of which I believe anthrax is, the researcher for the anthrax laboratory. We have other documents showing from their trainings that this is something that really got me a little bit nervous. Maybe it will get you nervous. Researcher of Department of Avian Diseases. Now, some of this is agricultural, right? A lot of these biolabs look at threats to agricultural populations, animal populations. But some of it is weaponizing those biological threats to animal populations. So there's always two sides to that type of research, because you could drop a nasty biological weapon into a population of cattle or pigs, whatever, and decimate the industry of the agricultural industry of a country. Head of the Brucellosis laboratory, Brucellosis. Look it up. It's a pathogen, and it's been used in biological weapons research. That's what we're supporting in Ukraine. Training those folks. So we're not allowed to talk about that in the context of the Russia thing, because there's all this political correctness for Ukraine and Russia, that you can't criticize anything that's happening within the Ukrainian government or anything that the United States has been doing in Ukraine. Well, I, for one, am going to criticize the fact that the United States has been for 20 years in one of the most corrupt countries in Europe, if not the world, funding dangerous pathogens in biolabs, or funding the handling of dangerous pathogens in biolabs. And we're still doing it. And it's probably even more dangerous given the war scenario that we're facing there. I mean, do we have U.S. officials in Ukraine right now at these biolabs? I don't know. Is this training going on right now? I don't know. The documents aren't clear on that. Because much of the documents were from 2018 and 19, from what I recall. So maybe Congress can look into this. Hey, Biden administration, are we doing anything with anthrax in Ukraine? Why are we shutting it all down? I didn't see anything about gain of function here, but I'm sure it's happening. So this is why Judicial Watch is so great. Many of reasons Judicial Watch is great. But we've got this war going on in Ukraine. And at one of the big issues is biolab safety in Ukraine. And it's little old Judicial Watch is getting the key information about what's really going on there. Yes, we are supporting biolabs in Ukraine. Now, the Biden administration says it's all designed to reduce the threat. Now, to be fair, I'm going to read directly from the Defense Threat Reduction Agency's website about what they say they're up to there. The U.S. Department of Defense's Biological Threat Reduction Program collaborates with partner countries to counter the threat of outbreaks, deliberate, accidental, or natural, of the world's most dangerous infectious diseases. The program accomplishes its biothreat reduction mission through development of a biorisk management culture, international research partnerships, and partner capacity for enhanced biosecurity, biosafety, and biosurveillance measures. The Biological Threat Reduction Program's priorities in Ukraine are to consolidate and secure pathogens and toxins, a security concern, and to continue to ensure Ukraine can detect and report outbreaks caused by dangerous pathogens before they pose security or stability threats. I don't know about you, but I understand now. I don't believe that the best way to handle the threat of anthrax in Ukraine is to let any anthrax remain in Ukraine. Do you trust our government and the Ukrainian government to figure out how to keep that secure? I've got three words for you: gain of function. We can't even, based on the documents that we've uncovered at Judicial Watch and exposed, we can't even manage our own biolabs here in the United States without putting the population and those working in them at risk. We've got this program in China we've been running through Fauci that's resulted in, I think has resulted, I know it's not for sure, but I think has likely resulted in COVID. And gain of function still going on here in the United States. And this same gang is managing Ukraine? Who do they got running it, Burisma? I say sarcastically, I know Burisma isn't running it. What a nightmare. And it's Judicial Watch that's exposing it. First up, though, is Election Day. Or is it Election Week? Or is it election, it looks like, months? As you know, I've been highlighting the effort to undermine our election system by expanding the notion of Election Day to election weeks, election months. And we're seeing this in outrageous fashion, in my view, in Arizona and in Nevada, where there are at least three major races, maybe four, if you count the governorship of Nevada, I'm not sure where that stands. And two of those races could essentially tell us who's going to be running the United States Senate, Republicans or Democrats. The Senate in Arizona, the Senate seat in Nevada, they don't know who won, or they are counting the ballots in such a way that it may take weeks, if not months, before we're told who is the winner. Now,
I don't probably need to convince you that's outrageous. Counting ballots after elections, despite what the media tells you, despite what the big tech censors tell you, is inappropriate. It's not normal in the sense that it should be encouraged. And it invites fraud and undermines confidence that voters have a right to have in elections. So when you're counting ballots after election day, it raises questions inherently. And the media would like you to believe, ignore what you see, ignore the man behind the curtain in terms of election integrity, which is the endless counting of ballots in a way that, you know, I think that honest Democrats, or at least voters, don't like this notion of elections going on for weeks. But, you know, this is the reality of the left's restructuring of our election systems, with the media's help, trying to program us to accept the decimation of election integrity. And in Maricopa County, Arizona, we've been investigating this as well. It was further undermined by the failure of it's kind of a bipartisan problem in Arizona, because the state is the state official, Katie Hobbs, the Secretary of State, who's running now for governor. Her office is responsible for machinery, and Maricopa County, obviously, generally, the election's administered by the Republican-controlled government there. And according to at least one lawsuit that was filed, upwards of 30-35% of election tabulators and printers were not working. So what happened there is that voters were trying to have their votes counted while they waited. You know, essentially, it'll be run through the machine, it tabulates your vote, and then you leave. But the machine wasn't reading, or many machines, or too many machines, however we want to characterize it, weren't reading the ballots. Or, I don't know, maybe they were reading it, but either way, they were getting rejected. And so voters were being told, well, you can wait online and wait for them to fix it, or you can essentially drop it in the box, supposedly a secure box, and it would be voted counted later, at least hand counted. Well, I don't even know how they'd be counted later, whether they'd be hand counted or tabulated in a different machine. Or you could take your ballot, I guess, tear it up and go vote somewhere else. So it sounds confusing, doesn't it? It sounds something that you might not like to go through if you're just trying to vote. It sounds like something that makes you think, I don't know if my vote's going to be counted. It sounds confusing in the sense that I don't know what to do. Maybe I just won't vote. It sounds confusing in the sense that these directions are difficult to convey generally, and are they being conveyed directly or correctly by the numerous myriad election officials who were stuck having to explain why the machines weren't working. And indeed, as I report to you here, my understanding is those ballots that were unable to be tabulated on site, but were left behind by voters thinking they'd be counted later that day, still haven't been counted. So you've had this systemic breakdown of on-site voter tabulation that was planned in Maricopa County. And Maricopa County, for those of you outside of Arizona, is the biggest county in Arizona. It's where most of the people live. It's kind of like the New York City of New York. It's basically where everyone lives. And with all due respect to the wonderful residents of Arizona who live outside Maricopa County. And so this is not a small matter. So no one knows when these votes are going to be counted. And then on top of that, you have in Nevada, Clark County accepts ballots mailed as long as they're, quote, postmarked on or before November 8th up until Saturday of election week. So we don't know when those ballots are going to be counted. Last I saw, the official said, we expect unofficial results next week, next Thursday. When are the official results? Who knows? So the idea that we have these key races in, you know, Arizona is one of the most important states in the union, certainly when it comes to elections. And we don't know who's winning one way or another, or who's going to win, because the numbers change depending on what batches are arbitrarily released in a way that undermines confidence in the elections. So I want to repeat again, this is what our goal should be. Our goal should be to encourage people to vote in person on election day. We should not have mass mail-in balloting. We should not have early voting that goes on for weeks and weeks beforehand. And we should demand that systems are in place to ensure that ballots are counted on election day, not for days and weeks and months afterwards. And of course, anyone who votes should be required to show a secure voter photo ID. And certainly anyone who's registered to vote and or who votes should also be confirmed to be a United States citizen. What's so hard about this? You know what's so hard about it? That policy, those basic election integrity measures, are opposed by the left. Why do I think they oppose it? Because it makes it harder to steal elections. And they want to be able to steal elections when possible. There's no other reasonable explanation. It doesn't necessarily impact individuals who are voting it by race or any other classes. So there's nothing discriminatory in these regulations. They pretend they are, but there aren't. You can see that in Georgia, where you've had this tremendous turnout, irrespective of the increased security measures for voting down there. So as long as we have mass mail-in ballots, we're going to have elections that people won't have confidence in. And if conservatives are want to kind of be able to compete, forget about the the issue of the law and election integrity. You want people to vote and to feel like their votes are going to count. And if they think their votes aren't going to count, they're not going to participate. And I tell you, the best way to ensure that people don't participate is to have this mass mail-in balloting. Because conservatives don't trust it. And, the evidence is if elections are more secure, people of both political parties are more likely to participate. Minorities are more likely to participate. So the failure to address this mail-in ballot the increase in the use of mail-in balloting, the mass mail-in balloting, undermines election integrity. And as in the case of Arizona, it wasn't even the mail-in balloting. It was just a lack of either incompetence or I don't know if it was corruption. Certainly, we're going to be asking questions. But this casual approach to counting ballots and being told is perfectly normal. It isn't normal. It isn't normal. And anyone who tells you it's normal is promoting a partisan left-wing talking point. People want to know who won the election on election day or election night, not 3 weeks later. Because any adult looking at that recognizes that as an opportunity for fraud, and it undermines the confidence people have in the results. So the other big issue this week is the developments around the purchase of Twitter by Elon Musk. He finally purchased Twitter. It went through last week, and the left has gone crazy. They've gone bat sugar crazy, that's the best way I'm going to put it. Just they're aghast that there could be more free speech on Twitter. And as a result, they're trying to destroy Twitter. Let's be blunt, they're trying to destroy Twitter. Elon Musk just announced today that advertising revenue is dropped like a rock because it looks like the left has been pressuring advertisers to either pause or pull out their advertising from Twitter because they don't like the idea of free speech on Twitter. And by free speech on Twitter, they're not meaning Twitter going in and taking off pornography and things like that. They mean squelching speech like mine, squelching speech like Judicial Watch's, squelching speech like yours. You go on and you say the wrong thing about elections. If you complain about vote counting after the election day, they'll squelch your speech. They'll censor your speech. They'll suppress your speech. You know, not only on Twitter, but other big tech platforms. And Elon Musk hasn't really fixed it yet, but he's obviously showing signs he wants to fix it, which is driving the left crazy. And this week he was talked to civil society leaders, all of whom were leftists, it looked like to me, all of whom support censorship about these issues. And as he noted in his tweet, you know, he's been trying to appease these activists and it's gotten him nowhere. Well, we could have told him that, that's for sure. So, you know, that's the challenge when you have someone like Musk, who's relatively new to politics and certainly these ideological battles that, you know, they come in thinking, well, you know, maybe these folks will be operating in good faith. They're not operating in good faith. They'll destroy Twitter. They will destroy Twitter if need be. They don't have any interest in seeing it continue if they can't control it. That's the revolutionary left. The revolutionary left, which is communist in orientation, is in a situation, their approach these days is they will destroy institutions they can't control. And Twitter's on that list. And so I don't envy Mr. Musk's position in this regard. But, you know, he's getting a quick education as to what's happening. He's seeing the way the left is playing games with him, where he's trying to do the right thing, trying to accommodate them in terms of content moderation, what I call censorship. And he's still, you know, they're still trying to destroy his company. And this is what I tweeted to Musk earlier this week. Elon Musk, left have countless billions, and we'll put the tweet up there so you can read along. Left have countless billions, government entities, media, and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, focus like a laser on ensuring big tech and government suppress and censor online speech. Conservatives have a few social media accounts and a handful of groups fighting for online free speech. And he drove the left crazy by responding. He said, that assessment is more accurate than most people realize. And I don't know how anyone could argue with that assessment. The Biden administration wants to suppress online speech. Virtually every major academic who studies this issue wants to censor online speech. You have all these new experts arising who are experts in disinformation. The left are creating these groups designed to suppress, quote, disinformation, which is censorship. They want to censor speech that is legal and that otherwise should not be censored because they disagree with it politically. And of course, you have folks like Soros and other folks, you know, spending the money here. And of course, when the government's spending money on it, that's where you're talking about billions. And the media has reporters who are designated, and their whole mission is to ferret out misinformation and get it suppressed online, and to support the suppression of that. And so when you see the media talk about Elon Musk, their narrative is, oh, he's firing all these people at Twitter to save money because he's trying to save the company from falling on its face because it has too many people working for it who obviously aren't contributing to the bottom line. But their response is, oh, but will they be able to keep on censoring the way we want them to? Will they be able to suppress information and debates about elections, about COVID, about Ukraine, about transgender extremism, about abortion, you name it. I mean, the left thinks speech they disagree with is hate, and they think it is deserving of no protections in the private or governmental spheres. So they oppose not only free speech, but the First Amendment. And Musk is seeing that firsthand. So we'll see how it plays out. You know, Judicial Watch is on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. We're on all these other major media or social media platforms. We're constantly being censored and suppressed. I warned you a few weeks ago, we were talking about COVID. I'll be talking about it later. And I told you, there's going to be a Facebook warning about COVID, even though I'm just talking about either a lawsuit or documents we uncovered. I mean, I said COVID. So Facebook is going to have a warning. Last week, I was talking about abortion and a lawsuit that we had filed to uncover information about the safety of the abortion pill the Biden administration is trying to cram down everyone's throats. I mean that figuratively. That led to a vandalization of our video on YouTube, where they said something about abortion health information. Well, first of all, in my view, abortion is not healthcare, it's killing. So it's propaganda that they were trying to stamp onto our video because we were exposing something they didn't like. And so this is what we're facing all the time here at Judicial Watch. And Elon Musk comes and he wants to do something more modest in terms of censorship, because he's probably going to censor too much. You know, in the end, we'll probably disagree with him on what he considers to be content that shouldn't be allowed on Twitter. But that's not enough for the totalitarian left, because the key phrase you have to remember is totalitarian. It's all or nothing for them. It's all or nothing for them. I mean, they're trying to put people in jail who disagree with them. Why is it surprising that they're focused on suppressing the free speech of tens of millions of Americans? I mean, you have the President of the United States pushing it. And it's just, as I noted in our tweet, it's groups like Judicial Watch, a few accounts, you know, that are somewhat big media accounts like mine, Judicial Watches, some other accounts that, you know, are kind of standing against and are in a position to highlight these abuses of free speech and censorship. But everything else, all the king's horses, all the king's men in the government and in the private sector, more or less, the kind of the left-wing media establishment, they've all decided to throw free speech out the window and to try to upend the First Amendment. And we're going to stand against it, and we hope Elon Musk stands against it. So I would encourage you, I don't know if I would encourage you to get back onto Twitter immediately, since the censorship is still there. But if you get in there, if you go back on Twitter and see if you like it, be careful about what you put on it, because they will censor you still. What they're doing to Twitter, I think, could result in the end of Twitter, unless other good thinking Americans come in and say, enough is enough. We oppose destroying people you disagree with. That's not the way. That's not the American way. I hope the new Congress looks into this. And again, we've done most of the heavy lifting there already, is the COVID vaccine and what's going on with that. Why can't we get basic information about its safety studies that were relied upon by the government in as providing the basis for pushing it on the American people? If it is as wonderful as they say, if it is as safe as they say, if it is as effective as they say, they will be happy, wouldn't you think, to release all the studies that show that. But obviously, it's not happening. Judicial Watch has had to go to court repeatedly to get basic information about the safety and efficacy of the COVID vaccines. Others have tried and have been desperate to go to court and actually have been going to court. There's been a big case in Texas that has gotten some study information out. But what's going to happen here? Is Congress going to hold these agencies to account for the gamesmanship and the shell games they've been playing with these documents? I hope so. Certainly, we'll continue to do our own investigation while pressing for accountability as best we know how out of Congress. So we sued the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. Oh, now who runs that, you may ask? Dr. Fauci. So Fauci is involved, his agency, in the cover-up of vaccine safety study information. and we asked for records of all safety studies, data, reports, and analyses produced by the Division of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases relating to the safety of vaccines and or gene therapies to treat and or prevent SARS-CoV-2 and or COVID-19 made by Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson & Janssen. All emails sent to and from the following DMID officials, that's the Division of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases within the Fauci agency, the director, the head of the Office of Genomics and Advanced Technologies, the head of the Office of International Research and Infectious Diseases, the head of the Office of Regulatory Affairs, the head of the Office of Clinical Research Affairs, the head of the Clinical Trials Management Section, the head of the Virology Branch, the head of the Respiratory Diseases Branch, the head of the Influenza, SARS, and Other Viral Respiratory Diseases Section. I'm so proud to work at Judicial Watch because only Judicial Watch has the necessary expertise to know where all these documents are going to be. Because what happened with these COVID vaccine approvals is you had multiple agencies with inputs here. So you have FDA, you have HHS, you have CDC. HHS is, you know, CDC is a sub-agency of HHS, but then you have HHS proper. And then you have NIAID, Fauci's group, and then you have this subgroup within Fauci's agency. So in May of this year, the NIH had released a paper out of the essentially that had the Fauci group contribute, and it was titled "Safety and Immunogenicity," I think, of a third dose of SARS-CoV-2 mRNA vaccine, an interim analysis. And so, as you know from, or I hope you recall from prior Judicial Watch exposés as to what was going on with the approval of these, of this booster regime, that there was a lot of internal debates, certainly within the FDA, about whether this booster would do anything, whether it was needed, and there were questions about its safety that we exposed. So it's, again, up to Judicial Watch to come in and try to bust through the stone walls that the Fauci group, I call it Fauci Inc., has set up to protect themselves from accountability and scrutiny about their handling of this vaccine regime. And, you know, and the arrogant cover-up of the COVID vaccine safety information also further undermines public confidence in these already controversial drugs. I mean, if you're hiding records about their safety and efficacy, of course it's going to give people who are paying attention pause. And Judicial Watch, as I've repeatedly said, is taking the lead on all of these issues. And I just want to go through, because it's worth highlighting the important work we've done here. And it kind of reemphasizes that, you know, Congress has a lot of work to do, but we've done, we've already clear-cut a path forward because we have this information out there, and what are they going to do with it? In October, we uncovered FDA records regarding the COVID booster vaccines earlier this month that show that that one of the FDA people who resigned because he didn't like the way things were going said available evidence doesn't yet indicate a need for the COVID vaccine booster shots among the general population. In July, NIH records that we uncovered revealed an FBI inquiry into the NIH's controversial back coronavirus grant tied to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We found that the FBI was investigating these gain-of-function grants that Fauci was affiliated with. The records also show that Fauci's officials were concerned about gain-of-function research in China all the way back, and not only in China, but in Wuhan specifically, all the way back to 2016. And that EcoHealth, which was the vehicle for doing a lot of this gain-of-function research that is so controversial, they were worried about them doing gain-of-function again all the way back in 2016. FDA records show top officials being pressured by companies in the Biden administration to impose timelines on approval for the booster shots that make no sense. And that wasn't just the Biden administration generally, it was the Biden White House that was doing that. We found that in between 2014 and 2019, over $825,000 was given to the Wuhan Institute of Virology for bat coronavirus research by the NIAID, that's Fauci's group. We found that. No one knew about that number until Judicial Watch uncovered it. We found that Fauci's agency gave 9 China-related grants to EcoHealth Alliance to research coronavirus emergence in bats and was the NIH's top issuer of grants to the Wuhan lab itself. The records also included an email from the vice director of the Wuhan lab asking an NIH official, and this is a classic one, for help finding disinfectants for decontamination of airtight suits and indoor surfaces. So this Wuhan level 4 lab, level 4 means it's supposed to be really secure and safe, they didn't know how to keep it disinfected. I mean, I could have been running things over there with the way things were going. Calling up NIH, you know, what sort of Lysol should I use to keep it clean? That's what was going on. And Fauci knew this was happening. Or had happened. So I could go on and on. HHS records show the State Department and Fauci knew immediately in January of 2020 that China was withholding COVID data. And yet they praised their cooperation later. Fauci personally did that. HHS records regarding biodistribution studies and related data for the COVID-19 vaccines show a component, a key component of the vaccines, lipid nanoparticles, which is the kind of the vehicle through which the RNA is shepherded into the body, were found outside the injection site, mainly the liver, adrenal glands, spleen, and ovaries of test animals, 8 to 48 hours after injection. My guess is you're smart enough to know that's pretty outrageous, because they told us that necessarily that, you know, we didn't really have to worry about those particles and the spike proteins getting past essentially your lymph nodes on your arm, under your arm, once you were injected with the vaccine. That wasn't the case. And there's more, but I'm not going to get into it all with you because I don't think I can, my blood pressure will take it. So I don't know how better I can explain to you than what I just did in terms of the significance, historic significance of Judicial Watch's work in uncovering what went on with COVID-19 and the vaccines, which the scandal, which is continuing to this day. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and like our video down below.
Thanks for listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.